Welcome back to the Winter Palace. This is another live raw recording done right after we've left the movie theater. Justin is here again. Hello, Justin.
Hey.
So we have just seen Furiosa, the Mad Max movie. We decided it was good enough that we're going to do a pod. If it was poor or less, we're not going to do a pod to savage it. We're not going to bury it. We are going to praise it. I jokingly said during the credits that we would give it our usual 7 out of 10 highest rating in the honor of Jay Sherman. I would probably actually go 8. Definitely not 9. Probably say 8. What would you say?
Yeah, 7.5 out of 10. I was thinking, using the Letterboxd scale, out of 5 stars, I was going to say 3.5 out of 5. I feel like that's a fair, positive rating. For frame of reference, I had Fury Road as 5 stars. And if there was a higher thing than 5, I'd have given it that, too.
Well, unfortunately, they did not make Fury Road in the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, Dave Meltzer's not rating Fury Road. It wasn't at that level, but it was still pretty good.
Yeah. Obviously, the one sentence synopsis is it's Furiosa's origin. In fact, we'll get this nitpick out of the way. The movie actually, when the movie ends, during the credits, we actually get clips from Fury Road. I guess filling in for people who don't remember, but I think we both kind of agree it was a dumb idea.
Well, first of all, how many people that are watching this in a theater or watching a period have not seen Fury Road yet? And that's the whole reason people are going to see this. It's like less than 1% of the people, probably. So it just didn't make any sense. And also, it's reminding you of like a far superior film, right? You want let people like sort of like breathe in and like think about the movie they just watched for a second without hitting them with like, oh, remember this? Remember this? You know, remember Charlize Theron as Furiosa? You know, so yeah, I wouldn't have done that.
But yeah, overall, I mean, now that we've nitpicked that, we'll talk about some of the good things. So the plot is it's her origin. It shows her getting kidnapped as a little kid and taken to the movie's new villain, who is Dementus, who is played by Chris Hemsworth. I heard something today where somebody said this may be his best role ever.
He was fine in it. He was good.
It's not the kind of movie I think you would put on your resume, but he overacted in all the right ways in this kind of movie that you would want him to.
His overacting in this movie was appropriate in a way that it's not in any of the Thor movies, where he's going for Waka Waka Marvel laughs, which are kind of annoying and grating. In this movie, it made sense for his character.
Yeah, he tries to be funny, but he's not funny, and I think he's one of the he's a villain who thinks he's smarter than he is.
Well, he's also kind of like he's the kind of villain I kind of compare to like the serpent in the Garden of Eden. He's a bad guy, but he's also he's like telling the truth, right? Most of the time he's like telling it seems like he's telling the truth. And it's just like a complete, his character's like guided by cynicism and nihilism and whatever, but he's also like a realist, and you know, people don't want to hear that,
Well, one of the funny things, and yeah, this will be spoiler heavy, so I mean, you're not listening to this if you don't, I haven't already seen it, or you know, whatever, but early on, it's like his first two plans really don't work the way he thinks they will. And I said, you know, this would be funny if this was actually a 2-hour movie of him constantly coming up with supervillain plans that don't work. And like, just because he's not as smart as Immortan Joe, mm-hmm. or any of the other guys that he's run into, but that doesn't happen. He actually turns out to be he's a fairly effective leader, even though he's a sub-Bond... He's like the Bond henchman villain, probably.
He is clever and a little crazy, but, like, all these people... I mean, it's easy from our sort of, like, pre-post-apocalyptic perspective to say all these people are a little bit crazy. But, like, I mean, really, the only thing that kind of, like, brings him down is the fact that through a you know, A, Immortan Joe wants Furiosa for his harem, and through a series of whatever events, she kind of escapes and becomes who she is, and with a little help from some friends and stuff, and puts herself into a position where she can thwart his plans, right? But so it's not like Immortan Joe outsmarts him or anything. Like, you, like a great little detail, which they don't dwell on and nobody sits there and explains it or anything, that illustrates it, is like when he's trying to like draw Immortan Joe's war boys out in a diversionary thing while he launches his main attack on the Citadel. He has a water truck in front of his convoy spraying the thing so they're not leaving dust. There's no dust being kicked up as his, as they travel through that kind of like trench or revetment or whatever. And like, it's not dwelt on. Nobody even comments on it. It's just like, you see it and it's like, oh, okay, that's smart. That's what kind of, that's how savvy he is. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then, like I said, she gets captured as like a 7-8-year-old, something like that. And then, yeah, so she's his prisoner for a while. Eventually, he trades her to Immortan Joe for increased water and food rights. Even though it's kind of obvious that this is after he had tried to take over the Citadel earlier, and it didn't work.
So he took over Gastown.
So he eventually takes over Gastown. Although, as I was saying about his failed plans, it looks like he tries to sneak into Gastown by faking an attack on the gas truck, but they don't believe it eventually, which is when I said it would be funny if all of his plans don't work.
Right.
But eventually he fools the people running Gastown, so he ends up they sneak in and take over.
Yeah.
And so so we also see, one of the things you said before we started is you've watched all of the Mad Max films leading up to this.
Yeah.
So, is the Bullet Farm new, or has that always been?
I don't remember seeing it or even having it mentioned. Like, obviously, none of this stuff would have been mentioned in the first Mad Max, because that takes place before World War III, blah, blah, blah. So, but I don't remember it in The Road Warrior or in Beyond Thunderdome.
But it kind of makes sense, again, given...
But it was mentioned in Fury Road.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, it makes sense that it's not just Gastown and the Citadel, that you have sort of a triangle dealy bob, where it's like one place trades bullets for gas and water, and then the other... You know, so you've got the triangle trade going on.
Right.
So yeah, so eventually Furiosa is there. She eventually sort of breaks away. She's being kept as one of the child brides that we saw in Fury Road.
Yeah.
She eventually escapes from one of Immortan Joe's henchmen, who I believe for our wrestling connection was played by former WWF superstar Nathan Jones.
Rictus.
Yeah, Rictus.
Yeah.
There's Scrotus and Rictus. Those are his two.
His name in the credits is Rictus Erectus. So.
So yeah. So it looks like he had taken Furiosa out of her house or whatever, and may or may, you know, he apparently had his eye on her, but
yeah.
But she escapes, and they think she dies, but. She does these sort of classic 18th century thing of disguising herself as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So she becomes like a dog boy, and then she gets promoted up the ranks, where first she's working on like the girders and hooks outside, and then she becomes one of the mechanics, and she helps build one of the new big rigs.
Yeah, the war rig.
Yeah. And then she stows away on it, and then... Probably the best set piece in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. It's the best set piece in the movie. And, like, one thing that for sure I would have changed about this movie is I think it would have been better if there had been no kind of hint of a romantic attachment between her and, like, the Warwick guy who kind of takes her under his wing. Like, I feel like... it was kind of like, to me, the most moving thing in the film was, you know, after she like basically saves everybody's bacon and proves her worth on the war rig and they get out of it and stuff, she immediately like puts a gun to that guy's head and like, you know, because she's going to hijack the thing and go back home. And he like knocks her out of the truck and just keeps on trucking. But then he comes back for her, right? Because he respects her ability, right? He doesn't care that she just tried to put a gun to his head and tried to hijack him. He cares about her ability. And I think that even though they don't go too far into it, but there's only like one or two brief scenes, but like making it a romantic thing, I don't know. It wasn't necessary. And also I think it takes away from both of their characters just a smidge.
Yeah. They briefly tease it at one point later where, she gets stabbed by somebody and he's like sewing one of her many like wounds shut.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing. And then he looks, one of the things we haven't mentioned so far is, before her mother tries to rescue her and then she gets killed by Dementis. She tells her to like follow the stars and she'll always find her way home to the land of abundance.
Yeah.
So she draws like a star chart on her.
She tattoos
it. She tattoos it. She tattoos the star chart on her arms that she'll be able to find her way home. Chekhov's tattoo.
Well, one of the big things coming into this movie is like, okay, how is she going to lose her arm? Because you know they're going to... Like, in a perfect world, we wouldn't even have seen it. It would have just, like, it would have been elided in some way. But, like, you know that they're going to show it. They're going to make it this thing. So, I was thinking, like, okay... Is someone going to cut her arm off because they want to use that as a map or something? But fortunately, that was kind of subverted. And it was... The way that she lost her arm actually kind of made sense.
But so what I was going to say is... the truck driver guy sees the star chart. And then she actually opens up and explains to him. Because through a lot of the movie, she doesn't talk. Because they claim she's a mute. She never talks while she's being held prisoner by Dementis. She eventually talks to the truck driver guy, and then you kind of get this scene where they're standing there, and she tells him like how to get back to the land of abundance.
Yeah,
and then they do the thing where they like sort of knock heads, which is kind of like the Eskimo kiss.
Right, right.
That's
the intimacy kiss loves thing within. Yeah, you know, the land of the mothers or whatever.
Right, and then it sort of fades out, so we don't know if it actually went any farther or not.
Yeah, but it clearly, yeah.
Even if they didn't, they are affectionate towards each other, if not romantically.
Right, right.
So they eventually plan a way that they're going to escape. They're on to deliver the rig, and then she's going to escape, and he's going to. End up meeting up with her later, and then that plan doesn't work, and then they get captured again by Dementis, which is when he gets killed. We won't say how he gets killed, and that's when she loses her arm. Won't say how.
Yeah.
And then she ends up back with Immort and Joe, and she's going to she explains Dementis's plan of how they're trying to trick them into invading Gastown.
But a crucial thing there is there's like all these people who have their own different ideas about what's going on, like Immort and Joe's sons and, you know, his advisors and stuff. But Immort and Joe makes a point of like listening to her.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all. Yeah. Because one of his son, the one son says, like, we have three choices. It's like we can stay here, which is like the coward's plan. We can go fight them in Gastown, or we can go to the bullet farm. And then she says, no, he's trying to trick you. Yeah, and Immort and Joe listens to Furiosa over his sons and the guy in the suit.
Yeah.
So, and then there's apparently a long war, which...
A 40-day war, they say.
Yeah, there's a 40-day war of the wasteland, during which time...
Montage, bodies being piled.
Yeah, there's a Gone with the Wind kind of montage. This is enough time for Furiosa to build her mechanical arm, and also for her to get her to find the last working car left in the Citadel, which she eventually upgrades into, like, this nice souped-up sort of George Bear-style hot rod.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she tracks down Dementis and, you know, we won't say Dementis' fate, but one of the things that the historian guy says is there's lots of stories over the years of what she did. Did she shoot him in the head? Did she drag him behind her car, chained? And then we find out apparently what really happened, which is poetic and Twilight Zone-y and all those kind of things. And then that's where it ends. And then we see the credits with all the Fury Road clips. And we do briefly. There's one scene in the climax of the film when they're being chased through the desert, where Justin, there's like a long, there's a pullback, and we see a guy sitting on top of one of the sand dunes.
Well, not just that, but he's standing next to like the V8 Interceptor.
Right.
That
so
we've seen Mad Max drive.
Right. So Max has a cameo.
Yeah.
You know, he's never named. No one ever says his name.
You don't see his face. You just know that that's supposed to be him.
No, but I guess it does also help you place the film.
And he's
helps you put it in the timeline.
Yeah.
I guess.
He is credited as Max Rockatansky. So
right, but it's some guy.
Yeah.
It's not Tom Hardy or Mel Gibson or anything like that. That'd be funny. But, so overall, and we briefly touch on this, the thing that makes the Mad Max movie so great is the practical effects. We talked about the one scene where Furiosa is exposed as a girl. In the sort of classic Robert Louis Stevenson, the cabin boy's been a boy the whole, or been a girl the whole time,
right,
kind of thing. There's some rogue bikers who are trying to take down the war rig. There's three or four other set pieces that are pretty good. That's probably, like we said, that's probably the best one.
Yeah, the one where you see her in action on the war rig for the first time is like the highlight of the movie, I think, for sure.
And I would say there's definitely probably some callbacks to other films by some of the set pieces seem reminiscent if they're not.
Yeah.
If they're not direct homages, they feel like it with guys on parachutes and paragliders and.
Yeah, I mean, like, not, you know, it as well done as all these sort of like set piece sequences are. None of them are as good as anything we saw in Fury Road.
I was going to say, there's nothing as good as, the one set piece with the, and this is shown again in the credits, the guy playing the guitar.
Well, just everything. All the different chase sequences and fight sequences. Like, in Fury Road, one of the things that I thought was, like, great, it's like a subtle thing that established Furiosa's character. And, you know, take note, filmmakers who are like, here's how we have to talk about strong women, blah, blah, blah. And you have all these characters talking about strong women. Well, in Fury Road, nobody talks about strong women. You just see Furiosa commanding respect, being kick-ass and competent. And there's, like, a moment where one of the war boys who, like, when she steers that, and we're talking about Fury Road here, just so we're clear, where she, like, steers her rig off the course, right? And nobody knows that she's going to do that. And her sort of war boy assistant guy comes up and is like, Furiosa, what's going on? And she says, we're doing this. And he doesn't even question it. He's like, aye, Captain. And he passes the word down the line. It's only later they figure out what she's up to and they turn on her. But, like, the respect she commands is, like, instantaneous. And, like, it's unquestioned from, the like, those war boys. So, that's the kind of stuff, like, okay, that's her character.
But yeah, in this, I don't think anybody ever sort of, there's no scene where somebody questions, hey, who's this girl and why is she now the truck driver's assistant? It's basically like they're the only two that survived this attack.
Yeah.
And she's now also sort of like geared, you know, she's sort of like leather jacketed up like him and she's wearing the face paint and everything. So it's kind of like, you know, she was instantly made and nobody questioned it.
Yeah, it also makes me think, man, you know, Immortan Joe is awfully he's awfully benevolent for like an iron-fisted dictator, because like again and again his war rigs are getting destroyed and coming back with no stuff, and no one's being like strung up from the lanyard for everybody to see or anything like that. And he's a kinder, gentler post-apocalyptic dictator, I guess.
He's got like hundreds of thousands of war boys, so it's like, you know, who knows how many, who as we saw in the film, who like are willingly kamikazing themselves off the top of the citadel in the first fight.
Yeah,
because like not only are they throwing the explosive spears, like some of them are just chucking themselves off the cliff to try and blow up the Mentis's motorcycle gang.
Like Scotty Scheffler last weekend, they were awaited in Valhalla.
Yeah. I think everybody's pretty much fine in the cast. Other than Anya Taylor-Joy and Chris Hemsworth, I don't really even know. What's the truck driver's name? Is it Tom Burke?
Yeah.
But, like, it's a lot of Australian guy and Australian slash English slash... You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, when you're watching this movie, there's almost nobody else that you're going to recognize other than her once she That's the thing. It's like Anya Taylor-Joy doesn't even... She's not in the first hour of the movie because it's, like, little kid Furiosa.
Right, right.
It's like, eventually, you know, we get to the, you know, like, the war rig scene where suddenly it's her. Because, you know, otherwise, for a while it's a little kid, and then it's the girl is dressed, and once she goes to a Morton Joe, she's wearing sort of robes and stuff, so you really can't tell who it is. And then once she becomes a war boy, she's disguised as a boy, so she's wearing like a ski mask and like just like a black shirt and black pants. So you know, there's nothing to give it away. And even really, once she graduates to being leather jacket wearing long hair Furiosa,
yeah,
it's like, you know, it's not like she's ever really sort of dolled up in this film. I mean,
no.
You know what I mean? So there's none of that. But you're saying that I think it's a different guy playing Immortan Joe because the original actor passed away.
Yeah, whose name I can't remember.
I think so. So that may be a Stat Boy correction later, but
the guy who played Toe Cutter in the original Mad Max,
right? But yeah, other than that, it's just it's pretty much the few people that we mentioned, and then like thousands and thousands of extras, be they war boys or bikers or whatever the guys in the bullet farm are. I'm not sure what kind of mutant type refugees they are, but
lots of stunt people,
lots and lots. Yeah, we were joking about while you still have lots of visual effects artists credited in the credits, there's a lot of stunt people. I think Anya Taylor-Joy and Chris Hemsworth had like multiple stunt people, maybe.
Sure.
I think, as you can kind of, and the guy that played the truck driver, yeah, like I said, lots and lots of practical stunts, sort of like the hallmark of the Mad Max films, and certainly you're welcome. Although, you do get the wacky, it seemed like it was like wacky green screening done on purpose. You know, the kind of thing where like you get the intense zoom in on while people are driving.
Yeah.
The zoom in and out of when people...
It's, you know what, I think of it, it's like George Miller's version of like, you know, Hitchcock or his dolly zoom, or like Truffaut's dolly zoom, or like in Jaws when like, you know, the dolly zoom on like Roy Scheider's face. I think this is like George Miller's version of that. That's like his thing. Except maybe he's doing it digitally without actually dollying and zooming or whatever.
But I think there's not, you know, this is like a fun action film, so I think there's not a whole lot for us to really talk about, other than to say it's definitely worth seeing. I mean, among things in the theater, you know, I will give the credit to the theater that we went to tonight. We only had 10 minutes of trailers, thank goodness. I know, unfortunately, two of them were comic book movies, one being the Deadpool Wolverine movie, and one being the horrible Joker Harley Quinn movie.
Yeah, it's a toss-up which one of those movies I'm going to dislike more. It's hard to say at this point.
I know the one I will dislike more is the one that I will not see.
Which one is that?
That would be the Joker movie, because I still never saw the... I was so opposed to the Joker movie in principle, I never saw it.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I was not a fan of that Joker movie, for probably most of the same reasons as you didn't want to see it, it was better than any of the Deadpool movies. It's a pretty low bar, but like... Yeah, I'm not a fan of incel Joker, you know, Jerry Lewis and the King, you know, King of Comedy, you know, Joker. We don't need that.
The thing that, because I really haven't seen any of the press for this movie and not watched any of the trailers or anything, I guess this Harley is not Dr. Harleen Quinzel, apparently. For the way the trailer is presented, it does not appear that she is Dr. Harleen Quinzel.
You know what's funny? When the trailer started rolling, the first thing I thought was like, I can't wait to see the... And, you know, I thought this like as a joke, right? Oh, great. We're going to see the Joker do a whole new dance down a whole new different set of steps. And there's a fucking scene in like the trailer where it's like... him and Harley Quinn doing the dance together down. It's so dumb. God, it's so dumb.
Well, all I know is I was watching the trailer and I'm like, okay, knowing what this movie is, what horrible famous romantic standard are they going to be singing?
The biggest sin of that first, you know, Joker movie is that it thought it was so much smarter than it actually was. Like, this is a movie where it's like, look, man, we're going deep. You know, there's some deep psychology and commentary on media and what it's like. Dude, make the movie good first. Like, learn the rules, and then you can break them. Don't start off like, oh, I'm breaking all the rules. No. Yeah, the movie is terrible, and this one's not going to be any better.
Oh, it made me think of, I read a story the other day that... Just speaking of bad versions of Harley Quinn, and I don't think this is necessarily going to be a bad version of Harley Quinn, but I've heard there's already being flack among nerds, unsurprisingly, that the new Harley Quinn in the new Batman cartoon that Bruce Timm and Ed Brubaker are doing,
okay,
that Harley Quinn is apparently going to be Asian in this.
Eh.
And she's going to have a different origin. I'm like, well, if she has a different origin, then it's not really...
Right, yeah. Making her Asian is like, whatever, who cares? But, like, giving her a different origin, it's like, well, this is a character who the whole concept of it is, like, links her to the Joker, so.
Yeah, I don't mean, they didn't really give too much away. I think something he said was something like, this one is going to be, like, Harley is serious and, like, Harleen Quinzel is the funny one.
Nah.
So there's a weird, I have faith that with Brubaker, like, being the script editor, that cartoon's going to be good whenever we see it. So
one would hope.
But, I mean, it's like, you know, they reinvented Mr. Freeze and they reinvented the Mad Hatter, and I'll give him and Paul Dini credit for that. So if they want to reinvent...
Sure.
I mean, anything that will save us from, like, the horrible, annoying version of Harley Quinn that we have now...
Yeah, the Margot Robbie.
The whole... The whole modern interpretation.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything that isn't like the Arlene Sorkin Harlequin costume, Harlequin, I really have no... You know, yeah, the Suicide Squad, Birds of Prey.
Can I just tell you that Birds of Prey, with the giant preamble title, Harlequin,
yeah.
Okay. Literally one of the 10 worst films I've ever seen in my life. I mean... I wanted to gouge out my own eyeballs and, like... Who watched the dailies of these movies? Like, oh, yeah, that's good. That's good. Print. Let's get these prints out to theaters ASAP. Man, my God.
So you're saying, why couldn't that have been the film that David Zaslow destroyed for a tax credit?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Deprived, yes, of seeing Brendan Fraser as Firefly and... whatever else is in the presumable. I mean, if you were to make a bet, wouldn't you bet that they're still secretly, like, that probably still exists somewhere, that they didn't really destroy every single copy?
Well, maybe Marvel poached Brendan Fraser to play the Blob now that...
I don't really care about this background movie, but I do kind of hope that, like, they saved the Wile E. Coyote versus Acme movie.
Yeah.
Just because... And there's a way that that could be really clever on paper. I don't know if it will be, especially given that it stars... One of the stars is John Cena, so, I mean, how good can it really be?
Yep.
But, anyway, so now that we've digressed... See, Furiosa, apparently there's already been talk that, I don't know if it's officially been declared a bomb, even though it's still only Sunday as we're recording this, but I know I saw a story that it's apparently underperformed Friday, which we joked about this going into the theater. I said, oh no, this is going to be another bunch of articles about, oh no, people aren't turning out to see a female lead in an action movie.
So the impression I got from, like, the headlines I've seen is that, or the vibe I'm getting, I guess, is that this is less about the movie and it's more about people just not going to the movies, right? Because people, they think it'll be streaming on Max in 30 days, right? Or, you know, they're just staying at home. They're not going to theaters, unfortunately, because movies like this one especially, you should, like, go to the theater and see it. But, because the way those headlines are constructed, it's like, oh, worst ever Memorial Day opening. Well, it's like, well, yes, because every year it's worse and worse and worse, right, relative to where it was.
Well, it's like television ratings.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, yes, ratings are now worse every year. But that also doesn't mean that you can't point out when something has horrible ratings, as if, like, certain wrestling promotions. Like, when their ratings are horrible, it's not just because the ratings are less now. It's a combination of ratings are less and people do not want to watch your product.
Yeah.
But, yes, well, I mean, we were talking about when we were watching the credits, one of the things that we saw was a long trailer of all of the retro films that are being re-released in cinemas for, like, the rest of the summer. And it's just like, you know, this is now the only way they're getting people back into theaters, more or less, because we saw what was, like, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter,
yep,
The Mask, Jaws.
Yeah.
There were a couple others. I know a friend of mine told me that a younger friend of mine said that him and his girlfriend were excited. There's apparently going to be, like, a giant all-day triple feature of the Lord of the Rings films at some point. Because, sadly, he was too young to have seen them the first time around, and he's only seen them on DVD or on TV. And I'm like, boy, thank you for making me feel old when he told me that.
Well, by the time they're done watching those three right in a row, he'll be eligible for Social Security. I set a reminder on my phone that, you know, sent me a thing earlier today. Next weekend, I think it's next weekend, in certain theaters, you know, I think it's also like a Fathom Events thing, like the trailer we saw. It's like the 45th anniversary of the Muppet movie, the original. So I might actually go see that in the theater.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I poo-poo that. I mean, I know there's at least two or three times we've gone to see retro stuff. It's like,
look, if it's a movie that I really like that I have either haven't seen on the big screen or it's been forever, like when they did the retro Top Gun, I went to see that just because, like, the last time I saw it on the big screen was 1986.
Because we went, I guess, 2 years ago now when it was the 40th anniversary of Wrath of Khan. Which, again, is worth seeing in, well, one.
And I also went to a 35th anniversary Wrath of Khan also.
But, you know, that's, yeah, you know, arguably the best Star Trek movie. And, you know, something that...
It's not even arguable. It's without a doubt.
But I'm sure there are some people who would argue that 4 might be better than... I'm not.
Oh, my God.
I'm not. But I'm just saying 4 is like the usual... I mean, because it's not 1, 3, or 5.
To paraphrase Jerry Seinfeld, who are these people?
You know. But, yeah, so, I mean, we went to see that. Unfortunately, you couldn't go with me when I saw the Talking Heads movie. But that was also restored and...
Yeah.
That wasn't just a re-release. That was, a jazzed-up version. So that was definitely worth going to see.
Well, last weekend, the Fathom Events movie was, North by Northwest.
Right.
And I think later this year, there's going to be Rear Window, and I think... Yeah, so whenever they have, good movies... obviously, I could give a crap about, Harry Potter or whatever. But, I'm sure there's lots of people out there who enjoyed it when they were a kid. They're going to go see it, so... I'm all for the retro thing if it's if they're good movies.
I mean, certainly you would think that Disney, being the masters of that, would probably be wanting to put stuff back in the theater the way the kids, if you're not old enough to remember this, what Disney used to do with their classic animated films, back when films were actually animated and not made by computer, they would re-release their big films. They had a schedule where they would release stuff every, it wasn't 8 and it wasn't 20, but somewhere in the middle, because it's there's always more little kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you take you're 8 years old and your parents take you to see Snow White or Sleeping Beauty or Robin Hood or Mary Poppins or whatever. And so, 15 years later or whatever, it's okay, you've got nieces or nephews that are probably 8. Maybe you have a 6 or 7 of year old of your own by that time. And it's kind of the strategy when Disney would release VHSs early on.
Oh, yeah.
And then put them back in the vault. And people used to complain about them all the time. And it's You know, it's a sound business strategy, although it's Disney being Disney.
And then for decades ever after, an endless stream of people calling me at my video store back when those existed, asking me if we could order Song of the South. No, I'm afraid we can't. I think that would stay in the vault.
but conversely, how many times did people come in with Disney clamshell VHSs trying to sell?
A lot, every so often, we had a bunch of Disney clamshells that were out of print, and people would come in and pay. We put some on eBay too, so there was a market for it for sure.
Of course, the people who really wanted Song of the South knew the answer was you could import them because.
Well, yes, I saw so many bootleg. You could go to the farmer's market. Kind of flea market type places, and there'd be people selling bootleg Songs of the South. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it used to be in the days of Laserdisc, Disney was not selling them in the United States, but Disney was certainly selling them in Japan.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So that, if you wanted one bad enough for, whatever reason, whether it was historical or nefarious.
Things that are offensive in one country may be, whatever in another. So, yeah.
You certainly see Disney and Warner Brothers, now show questionable historical content as long as they put the disclaimer on that says, this was made in a different time.
Which is fine.
Right. I mean, I'd rather they do that than not show it at all.
Exactly.
Or edit it. Because where I wasn't expecting to see one of those, but... It did show up. It may have been Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett or Zora. One of those 50s DC shows.
Yeah.
And I went, for a second I went, what? And then I was like, oh yeah, because not the most flattering depictions of native peoples in these 1950s.
There was a movie, I'm trying to remember, was it a movie or a TV show? There was a movie that came out, I don't know how many, 30, 40, 50 years ago. I'm trying to remember. And I don't know if I was watching this on Turner Classic or on a different channel. But there was a trigger warning before the thing that there are scenes involving cigarette smoking. It's like, Like, are you seriously? This needs a trigger warning? My God.
It's like, you know, it's technically not illegal. Well, what's funny now is, like, there are probably movies that would have come out in the 50s that would have had a warning about drug use.
Yeah.
Because it was just for pot, and now you would probably make it, and, like, nobody would bat an eye about it.
The devil's lettuce.
But, you know, or something like Reefer Madness, or things like that, whereas you never know what would... Yeah, there was something I saw that was, like, a parental discretion thing advised, and I was like... It was, like, it was another thing that I did not realize that was, like, on the list now. And I was just like, huh? I was like, well... You know.
Yeah, I would much rather them put, like, here's a warning in case you're offended by stuff, rather than edit anything or just, like, not show it. Like, you know, classic example, something like Birth of a Nation, right? Or Gone with the Wind or whatever. And it's like, you know, nothing is served by, like, just not showing these movies or editing them or whatever. But, like, if there are people who are sensitive and or would be highly offended, they put the warning... So they know to avoid it or whatever. That's fine.
Oh, I mean, you know, from a cultural criticism point of view, it's like, yeah, when I was, you know, trying to do research on stuff, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it's like there's just stuff you couldn't find. It's like that would be in there. Now, like, you know, Warner Brothers released...
Certain Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Right. There was. It was a VHS that was called Bugs and Daffy the War Years. So it was specifically all of those cartoons that were made during the war that, you know, are now...
Especially the ones that deal with, like, the Japanese.
Right. Well, yeah. So I told somebody this not long ago, and they did not believe me. When I told them that there's an actual Bugs Bunny cartoon that's called Bugs Bunny Nips the Nips.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And...
Well, you know what's sad? Or maybe not, depending on your point. But, like, how many people today under the age of, pick an age cutoff, 45, 40, 50, whatever, how many people under whatever that age cutoff is would actually recognize that in America as, like, oh, that's a... slur referring to slang for Japanese or whatever. You know. So that's part of it.
I was going to say, we've had the discussion before about slur words and them being reclaimed and not reclaimed and how, you know, there's a certain slang word that you and I, when growing up, like, was a big no-no.
Right.
And now is so accepted that, like...
Well, now there's academic studies devoted to it.
Well, I was going to say, there are academic departments which have it in their title.
My philosophy on word, you know, language, words that could potentially be offensive is... It's the context that determines how offensive it is, right? To me. Like, because there are words that could be semi-innocuous or... anodyne in certain contexts, but highly inflammatory in others. And unfortunately, where we've gone as a culture, or at least some people in the culture have gone, is that in all circumstances, this is a radioactive nuclear bomb word and blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, you know. So I think that's a kind of reductive, limiting kind of like view on language and whatever. But
anyway.
Anti-intellectual, I would call it.
But the moral of the story is, go see Furiosa in the theater while you have the chance. Or, if you want to wait 90 days and I guess eventually see it on... This is a Warner Brothers film, right? So see it on Max.
Oh, it'll be... Yeah, it'll be on... I bet it'll be less than 90 days.
Well, we were talking before the movie that I had kind of wanted to see The Fall Guy. Even though I kind of knew it probably wasn't going to be very good... I was mainly curious to see if they actually did work the song in anywhere, which they did, as a spoiler.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. There's
Was Lee Majors singing it?
No, but Lee Majors does have a Lee Majors and Heather Thomas do have cameos.
If Lee Majors isn't singing it, it's not really the Fall Guy song.
I know, but it's in there. But it's in there.
Okay.
But like my schedule didn't really let me go the first couple of weeks it was out. And then, you know, like eventually I had time and I was like, "Eh, you know." And then like I looked the other day and it's like already streaming. Mm. So I was like, you know, maybe a month, maybe less than a month for.
Yeah, some of these go really quick. Like, I remember something, like, The Holdovers. Remember, did you watch that? No. Well, that like, was on Peacock, I feel like, within a month or a month and a half of when it came out in the theaters. It seemed like to me, anyway. There's a few of those things.
Well, it's funny, one that did not go to streaming as fast as I thought it would, probably because of how much money it was making, was the Mario movie. Like, the Mario movie, yeah. The Mario movie took forever because it just kept churning out box office.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Nintendo or Universal or whoever made the decision, you know, it was like maybe a whole year before it was on Peacock.
Mm. Yeah.
And then they put it out on for sale on DVD first, which you almost don't expect anymore. It's kind of like... Do, like, major motion pictures even... Like, do they even bother putting them out on DVD? Or is, like, is DVD only for us physical nerds who buy who buy Criterions?
Nah, they still put everything out on physical media, but what's happening is stores are stopping... You know, brick-and-mortar stores are devoting less space to it. So it's like you have to order it online, it seems like.
If you can find a brick-and-mortar store.
Well, right, exactly. You have to either go to Amazon or go to Criterion or go to, you know, Kino, Lorber, whatever, you know. Shout Factory.
Yeah, I guess so. Before we go, since we brought it up, you have any thought... I know you had some thoughts when we talked the other day about the Criterion sale to the guy who owns Indian Paintbrush.
My biggest concern is his age, because he's in his 70s, I think, right? And, like, it's... I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt. It seems like he's probably well-intentioned because of the fact that this company that he, you know, that he's used to finance all of Wes Anderson's films. Okay, fine. Or not all of it, but all of his films since, like...
Darjeeling.
Yeah, or Fantastic Mr. Fox or whatever it was. And... So I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, but my concern is, because of his age, you know, what happens if, God forbid, you know, knock on wood, like, if he kind of, like, passed away unexpectedly, what happens to the Criterion and Janus films? It just gets sold off to creditors or, like, the highest bidder? What does his estate do with it? Who's managing it? Because that, to me, unless he puts it into a trust of some kind... I feel like it lends itself to potential bad news for those of us who actually value Criterion.
I mean, it's like, there are certain people in Hollywood I really don't like. But, you know, but if you were to tell me that the guy, when he passed away, that, like, he made a deal that Criterion would be bought by, like, Steven Spielberg and Amblin, like, I'd probably feel okay with that.
Me too, yeah. I was just going to say, like, I'd like to think that if something like this, a scenario like I just described happened, that we would see maybe a replay of, like, what happened when Zaslav tried to, like, put, you know, cut the legs out from under Turner Classic Movies, and Spielberg and Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson basically, like, got a meeting with him in person to be like, yo, bro, what the fuck? You can't do this. I'd like to think that people like that would maybe get together and do something to, like, save Criterion, just because, you know.
It's kind of also like when Lucas and Coppola, like, helped fund Kurosawa's films.
Yeah.
In the, I don't know if it was just Ron or maybe some others, but I know.
Wasn't it Keigemusha?
Yeah, Keigemusha. That's what I meant.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
But, yeah, so you would like to think there's the people with deep pockets and like, it may not even be like the people that we know that have, like, that have even, like, deep, you know. Well, I mean, I guess I should say is, like, we don't want it to, like, be bought by, like, venture capitalists.
No.
And, like, we don't want it to be, like, be bought by one of the networks who will, You know, because it's like if Disney bought Criterion, you know, who's to say they wouldn't eventually shelve it? Or like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we've...
That would be so depressing.
Or, you know, it's like, you know, again, Warner Brothers would be like the logical people to buy it. But, like, we certainly wouldn't want Zaslow having his hands on the Criterion.
That's the thing, like, if Time Warner was being run by Ted Turner, right? Great. Be great. But, yeah, this current management has not done much to fill one with confidence about their respective business decisions to this point, so.
Definitely. So, yeah, so see Furiosa in the theater if you can. You're going to wait to see it on Max, see it just to help its numbers. I don't know what films are coming out in the future for the next installment of this now series. I don't even know like what is coming out the rest of the year that I'm even interested in. So we did spare people having the discussion about Napoleon.
Yeah, you still haven't seen it.
Which
yet,
no, because it's on Apple and I don't have Apple TV.
Okay.
And I have not managed to procure another copy of Abel Gance's Napoleon, which...
I have thoughts.
I know you have thoughts, and I know they're not going anywhere.
And they're not good ones.
No, and it's like...
I'll leave you with this, right? I'll pose this question. And I've asked other people this, too. Can you think of another actor who has given performances as great in his career as Joaquin Phoenix, who has delivered a performance as bad as the one he gives in Napoleon? I guess Brando's a contender because he had some stinkers.
I would say immediately off the top of my head, I bet you could probably say that about De Niro and Pacino.
Oh, man.
I mean, given some of the like weird later year choices. I mean, Pacino, after a certain point, I don't even know... I don't know when you could say Pacino's last good film was.
Well, I feel like both of those guys just evolved kind of into...
Or is that also because they've lost their fastball and...
Well, it's like they're old and they kind of have become characters of themselves. But I still don't think that's as bad as what we got from Joaquin Phoenix.
I guess... here's a question. Because I guess he's sort of like the best maybe contemporary comparison. Has there been a really awful Daniel Day-Lewis performance?
Not that I can think of.
To like that degree?
No. I don't know that he's ever given a bad performance on film. I have to think about that.
I mean, there are some films I didn't like.
Yeah, but none of the films he's done that you wouldn't have cared for. You wouldn't say it's because he gave a bad performance.
No, although, I mean, again, there's like his weird, I don't want to say overacting, but like, I don't know what the right word
is. He's intense, right?
But I mean, there's certainly like, I don't know if it was a word yet, but like, some of the memeable scenes in either like Gangs in New York or There Will Be Blood.
Right, but
then maybe that's because they're taken out of like when you take "I drink your milkshake" out of context.
Exactly. That's like judging, God, what's his name? Who's a German actor? Bruno, the guy that played Hitler in Der Untergang.
Right.
You know who played in Wings of Desire? Like, you know, he's an amazing actor, and his performance as Hitler was amazing, but. When we think of him and we think of that movie, we just think of like
the memes.
Yeah, Hitler upset that like the New York Rangers lost again or whatever, and he goes ballistic, right? But yeah, I mean, so that's how I think about the thing with like Gangs of New York or There Will Be Blood. But like, yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis, his resume is pretty impeccable, I would say.
I'd have to like look at the whole thing to like think if there's like if either something like really early in his career or like maybe some of these like really low budget like didn't really see, you know, I'd have to look at the list.
Well, but the issue is like you have to look at the list and then you need to watch the Ridley Scott Napoleon because Phoenix is so bad. He's so bad in that. So it's, and I don't know. But here, the only thing you can say in his defense is, did Ridley Scott tell him to act like this, or was he just kind of like doing his own thing? Whatever the cause, the end result was not good, and that's an understatement.
So there's something for people to look forward to. Again, and if you can find the four-hour version of Abel Gance's Napoleon, which...
That's being re-released, I think, on disc later this year. There's like a new print, I think.
That's good, because yeah. I know there's like there's a BFI print from a couple years ago, but that is, I think, out of print, and if you try and find it online, it's very expensive. It's kind of surprising that, like, that's not, like, public domain and just on YouTube.
Well,
or in, like, archive.org or something.
It probably is. And also, a friend of mine told me that there's a high-quality copy of it that's a bit torrentable. So.
But it's the kind of thing where I think with certain silent movies, someone told me that it's not necessarily the print, it's the score.
Yeah.
So, like, Metropolis. Metropolis is, like, public domain.
Yeah.
Let's say. I'm pretty sure it is, but yeah. if it isn't. But, like, the Giorgio Moroder colorized version with all the rock songs...
Right.
...is not public domain.
Right.
I would actually encourage people to see that because it's very weird. I mean, it's like, if nothing else, like, watch Metropolis... Like, with the Giorgio Moroder soundtrack with, like, Kim Carnes and maybe Bowie and a couple other people. And if you don't like it, go back, turn the color off on your TV, and then just watch the black and white version.
And then do yourself a favor and watch Alex Proyas's criminally underrated Dark City.
That should be The Matrix?
Yeah. Although I don't want to crap on The Matrix too much.
The
first one, right. The franchise as a whole, yes, but the first one is like still pretty good.
You know, that's an idea, now, speaking of The Matrix, for a pod that we could do at some point, because this is now long enough ago, and how old we both are, is this is like the 25th anniversary of the amazing year 1999.
Right.
Because in the very first issue of the magazine, if people can actually find copies that aren't in boxes in my house, I wrote an article that I think you may have also contributed to or posted your own list of, like, all the great movies that came out in 1999. Like, there's so many that you can leave off great movies from a top 10 list.
Yeah.
But, like, it's not all the ones that people say.
Right.
Like, unfortunately, like, people would make, like, a top five list from 1999 and put, like, The Matrix and American Beauty on it.
Right.
Whereas we would make it and put, like, Being John Malkovich, yeah. Like, The Limey.
Blair Witch Project.
Blair Witch Project.
Office Space came out in 1999. Just realized that the other day.
There's at least... And then there's, like, there are really good movies that people kind of don't even remember.
Run, Lola, Run.
Run, Lola... But for us in the United States, Princess Mononoke came out in 1999 for us.
Did it come out in 2000? Yeah, I guess it did. Yeah, it did. Yeah, I guess Spirited Away is the one that came out in 2001.
Right. Like you said, and Topsy Turvy. And then, like, things that people don't even remember that are good but not great, like Cedar House Falls, you know, which was like... A good sort of sappy Oscar kind of movie.
Oh, you mean Cider House Rules?
Yeah, that's what I mean. See, no. The fact that I got the name wrong proves my point.
Man, classic scenery chewing from Mike O'Kane.
Right.
Good night, yo, princess, yo, rob, rob. I mean, Christopher Nolan must have been watching that movie and stroking himself like, I've seen the future of all my films. It's Michael Caine reciting fucking poetry. Do not go gently into that good night.
And then he thought, this guy could be my Alfred if I ever make a Batman movie.
What, Master Bruce, why do we fall down? Well, if you don't pay attention this time, I'm going to repeat it four more times in the movie, and you'll learn it so we can pick ourselves back up. Michael Caine.
But, yeah. So there's something we could do in the future is, like, actually look at 99 and say what has been forgotten that shouldn't be and what is now, in hindsight, vastly overrated. Oh, Phantom Menace.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of. Yeah, because it had a anniversary release not too long ago to bring it all back.
I mean, as bad, it's so funny. If I could travel back in time, like, man, how disappointed I was in Phantom Menace. But if I could travel back in time and tell myself, look, if you think this is bad, wait until The Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker and Rogue One and all these just awful, awful stuff. You're going to be like, man, Phantom Menace, I could live with Jar Jar. Man, God, how far we've fallen. Unbelievable.
So in that bit of happiness, there's something for you people to look forward to in the future. So thank you, Justin, once again.
No problem.
And so we will be back. Until then, the balcony is closed.